Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update, a weekly program that looks at the economic dimensions of our lives, our jobs, our incomes, our debts, the wealth we have accumulated or not, the problems we face in funding the education of our children, all of that. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life at several universities, and I currently teach at the New School University in New York City. I want to mention to you before we jump into today's program that in the second half we will have a very interesting interview with a visiting professor from Great Britain, although he's originally from Texas. I also want to remind you that we maintain two websites where you can find out a great deal about what we do on this program, and indeed a great deal more. The first one is rdwolf.com, and the second one is democracyatwork.info. And I'll have more to tell you about those websites and what they enable you to do later in the program. Let's jump right in with the opening part of each program, which are short updates about items in the news that you might not have heard about and where we can provide an angle of understanding and interpretation you will almost certainly not have heard before. I want to begin today with a report just out by the Commonwealth Fund. It's a research foundation that does very interesting work. And they've done some work on private health insurance. Most Americans, if they're covered by a health insurance program, are covered by a private health insurance program, usually through their employer. And the Commonwealth Fund asked a simple question. How have people been doing over the last decade, basically the years 2003 to 2013, in terms of their medical insurance? We've been a nation engaged in an immense debate on that subject. We've had the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare. We've been debating and discussing and fighting about that for several years now. So what's actually been happening? Well, the most stunning statistic in the report that I want to read to you, because it's so clear, is the following. Between 2003 and 2013, the deductibles charged to individuals who have private health insurance have more than doubled. In fact, they've gone up 146% by average. The deductible is the amount of money you have to pay out of your pocket before the insurance you have kicks in to cover your medical expenses. So when you add the increase in premiums that private individuals have had to pay, together with the rising deductibles, the part that they have to pay out of their medical bills, you get the second most impressive statistic. Between 2003 and 2013, the cost of the premium to the worker, not the part paid by his or her employer, the cost to the worker of your premium plus your deductibles have gone from 5.3% of the average citizen's income in the United States to 9.6%, almost a doubling. So with all the talk and all the promises and all the posturing of our political and medical leaders, if they deserve the term, what we've had as the bottom line is that the cost of medical insurance has gone way, way up over the last 10 years for the people of the United States. And as if that weren't bad enough, and remember, that's a time when we've had the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression, so that on top of all the difficulties in our jobs, our benefits, and so forth, the cost of our medical insurance has gone up. But the biggest increase is in the deductible. So I want to drive home a point about that. If the first $1 or $2,000 of medical costs you have are your responsibility as a working person, before your insurance with your employer kicks in, guess what's going to happen? And you don't have to take a long time to make this guess. You're not going to go to the doctor if you don't desperately need it. You're going to postpone it. You're going to avoid it. And the same is true of medicine that you may need, because it's dollar for dollar out of your pocket. So what is likely to happen, and the statistics already show it is happening. People are going to the doctor less. People are using medicine less. People are postponing procedures. And guess what a rule is that every self-respecting doctor will tell you? Don't do that. The longer you wait to deal with a medical problem, the more serious it's likely to be, the more difficult it will be to cure, and the longer and more expensive the treatment will be. So what you're doing to the mass of Americans is clear. By jacking up how much they have to pay, you are reducing the medical care they get. You're deteriorating the health of the population. There's no pretty way to describe this other than to say it's part of the destruction of the standard of living of the American people that this economic system is foisting upon us. And these latest statistics from the Commonwealth Fund show it clearly. In my next update, brief one, but one that deserves some attention, the very first days of this new year, 2015, were the scene of the annual meeting of the American Economic Association in Boston, Massachusetts. It is an annual event that brings together many of the economists and professors of economics, especially around the United States, to see what one another are doing and to catch up on old friendships and also to hire the few young people that there are any positions for. But this year's annual meeting was characterized by something a bit unusual. A significant group of students and young faculty, and indeed a few not so young faculty, protested. They protested against the profession's refusal to be open-minded, to allow alternative perspectives to have a proper place in the academy and therefore a proper place in our society. Led by a young man named Keith Harrington, whom I know, who has a new project called Kick It Over, a project that criticizes and rejects mainstream economics on the grounds that it is trying to monopolize the concept of economics, monopolize the teaching, monopolize the way we interpret and gather our statistics, that it is a fantasy whose job seems to be to rationalize and justify the status quo rather than to raise honest questions and debates about it, untouching real the world that we live in and living in a fantasy, as he puts it, a kind of narrow, orthodox fundamentalism. And I wanted to give a shout out to congratulate these people for the courage they have to make their views known, to tell them I couldn't agree more, even though I am a professor of economics all my life and part of the very profession they're criticizing. I wanted to remind those who may not know about it that back in the 1960s, a similar effort was started that led to an organization, which is still around, called the Union for Radical Political Economics, IRPE, as it's called, which produces a journal, The Review of Radical Political Economics. And so this is a continuing struggle. And it is necessary because the profession remains as narrow, orthodox, and fundamentalist as you could imagine. In most economics departments, you cannot get a job if you are a Keynesian, and you cannot imagine a job if you're a Marxist, let alone several other varieties of economic analysis that are simply not allowed. And that's why so narrow a perspective characterizes our political leaders and our journalists, because they've all gone through a schooling system. It's as if in economics, let me give you a metaphor that may grasp it best. Imagine a department of religion in a university that taught only one variety of Southern Baptist. And instead of saying, well, we are one variety of religion, these Southern Baptist ladies and gentlemen came across as if their religion was the only one. Well, most of us would rebel. Certainly there's a place for Southern Baptism among religions, but it's only one among many. The same ought to be true in economics, with the neoclassical economics tradition, the current mainstream, taking a step down and not claiming it's all of economics, it's just one approach. But they resist doing that. And they resist it despite the fact that their profession, their mainstream, was notably blind and didn't see this crisis coming, and has been noticeably unsuccessful in its various strategies for coping with it. You'd think a failure as doubled and colossal as that one would have led to some modesty about putting forward that you're the only way. But if you thought that, you'd be wrong. I thought it. John Weeks, my guest, thought it, and we were all wrong. We didn't understand how a desperate group of folks who have invested their whole careers in one way of thinking would try to hold on. And no one illustrates it better than the person who sits in the dominant chair up at Harvard University, one Gregory Mankiw by name, who is constantly doing economics as if his mainstream neoclassical approach were the only one, and whose most famous latest speech and analysis was justifying the growing inequality in the United States as if it were A, inevitable, and B, a good thing too. So my hat's off to the people who are protesting. It's part of the growing movement in this country to open us up from the self-indulgent fantasy life we have about our economic system and beginning to face the reality that that we live every day, but that now has to be reflected also in how we think. The next update is a very simple one, and I can be as brief as I try to be, and I don't always succeed. It has to do with the numbers and the economics of our Senate here in this country. You know, we have two houses in our Congress, the Senate and the House of Representatives, and the Senate gives us an insight this time that is remarkable. The current Senate, that includes the folks elected last November, because we elect one-third of the Senate each time, the Senate that's sitting now is the Senate that was elected in 2010, 2012, and 2014. It's got in it 54 Republicans and 46 Democrats. That is, the Republicans now control the Senate, and there's been a lot of discussion about that. Here's something that isn't so well known that has an economic angle. How many people voted for the 46 Democratic senators compared to how many people voted for the 54 Republican senators? This is going to shock many of you. But here are the numbers. The 46 Democratic senators were elected by 68 million votes. The 54 Republicans, that is, they're the majority, they were elected by 47 million votes. That's right. The minority Democrats got almost 50% more votes than the majority Republicans. Why? Because the Republicans were able to capture small states. The small states have two senators, just like the big states do. And now, why is this interesting besides raising a fundamental democratic question? If democracy means the majority rules, then the majority voted overwhelmingly for Democratic senators, not for Republicans, but the Republicans have the majority. By the way, the same would happen in reverse if the two parties worked differently. It's not about the party, it's about the fact that we allow the Senate to be elected in this patently undemocratic way. But the economics of it are simple. If you want to control the Senate, then you don't need to spend as much money as you might imagine, because you would be logically advised, go spend less money to capture the little states, and you'll control the Senate. And the little states are where it's cheaper to buy advertising. The little states are where it's cheaper to buy time on the television. So the little states are where the wealthy can and should go to maximize the impact of their money in terms of their goal of controlling politics. You can win 47 million votes, lose 67 million votes, and still control the United States Senate with all that implies. Money and a non-democratic system seem to go together to give dominance to those who have and deprive influence from those who don't. That's our system in reality, not in the abstract theories of our political science professors, which is, after all, what those folks up in Boston were trying to get across about economics earlier this month. Last short update we have time for. I want to recognize a remarkable labor strike that's about to begin a little bit later this month in the state of California, a statewide strike in California by the mental health workers who work for a company called Kaiser Permanente, a major health institution operator in this state. 2,600 mental health clinicians, psychologists, therapists, and social workers are due to walk out. And what's interesting about their strike is that they've made it very clear. They're striking because the quality of mental health being delivered to the people of California is woefully inadequate. Their argument is quite clear. Kaiser Permanente is a profitable private enterprise. Its main goal is to provide profits to the folks who own it. And in the process of doing that, they cut corners, say the workers. And they don't deliver the kinds of services that the people of California need and want and pay for. And so the union of these workers is going on strike. But notice, it's not going on strike to get more money for itself. It's going on strike for what it says is its primary purpose, to get the quality of work they do and that they want to do to be adequate to what the situation demands and what the people deserve. It means that the union confronts the private profit-driven medical system and throws it into question. And that is of interest to everybody. And it means the unions are beginning to understand, perhaps, that they need a broader framework in which to argue what they're putting, to be champions of something that everybody wants, and not to allow themselves to be positioned and perceived as being interested only in an extra few bucks for their particular members. It is an interesting redefinition of how a union moves forward, and I believe it will affect others, and my hat's off to the creativity of this union for figuring out this way to move forward. Okay, we move now to a second part of our program today in which I respond to questions that you have sent in. And I want to do this again in the time that we have. So pardon me if I talk quickly or even more quickly than I normally do. The first question, many of you have sent this in, and again, I want to remind you that you can go to either of our two websites, rdwolf.com, Wolf with two Fs, or democracyatwork.info. And through either website, you can communicate to us questions, comments, criticisms. We get more questions than we can possibly answer, so I select a few each week, and I try to select those that reflect many of your interests. So please keep them coming. We read and use everyone in shaping this program. So many of you want to talk, or wanted me to talk, a little bit about Greece, because it's in the news so much and you're concerned, and rightly you should be. So let me be as comprehensive as I know how and as brief as I know how. Because of the complexities of Greek parliamentary law, which I don't want to go into, and they're not that important, the sitting government in Greece had to declare an impasse. It could not continue. It lost certain votes in the Greek parliament. Bottom line, there has to be a new election, and that election will take place on the 25th of January this year, so later this month. This is an interesting election. Why? Because the two parties in Greece that played football with the government, that is, one of them had it for a while, then the other one had it for a while, a little bit like the Republican and Democratic parties in the United States, those two parties in Greece, one called the Greek Socialist Party and the other one called New Democracy Party in Greece, they used to get 3/4 of the vote between them in every election. They now are lucky if they can get 30% of the vote between them. That is, a majority of the Greek people have abandoned the two traditional parties because they're so disgusted with what has happened in Greece over the last 4 or 5 years. Let me give you a brief, quick summary of what has happened in Greece. Approximately 1 million people have lost their jobs. That's 1/4 of the labor force in Greece, 1 million people. Youth unemployment is over 50%, and Greece is therefore a country a large portion of whose young people are leaving the country again, the way they did in the 19th century and early 20th century, to find jobs in the United States and Europe, which is a remarkable thing to do, given that there are no jobs in the United States and Europe. It's just even worse in Greece. A third of businesses have closed. Salaries have sunk roughly 40%. Pensions have been reduced by half. The total economy has contracted by a quarter. There's been a 43% increase in child mortality. The health system has broken down. The Greek economy is in a deflation. And the public debt, which was supposed to be improved by all of this, is now higher as a percentage of the gross product of that country than it was before. It's increased from 130% of the GDP of Greece to 175%. Greece, economically speaking, and beyond that, is a disaster. And so the traditional parties, Republicans and Democrats, take note, the traditional parties have been abandoned by the Greek people. And they have done one of two things. The majority have moved to the left and supported a new emerging socialist party called Syriza. And indeed, the polls right now suggest that the election will be won, the election on the 25th of January, by the Syriza party. But they've also moved a bunch of people in Greece to the right, which is typical when these kinds of things happen, that you go to both extremes. There, the party is called Golden Dawn and takes a position against immigration, a kind of a traditional right-wing position. But fortunately for Greece, that's much smaller, the move to the right, than the move to the left has been. If Syriza wins the election, it will become the government. And it has taken a strong position against austerity. That is, they're not in favor of dealing with the crisis of capitalism, which is a crisis of all of Europe, all of North America, basically of the world, as if it could be solved by whacking the standard of living of the Greek people. They won't allow it. They won't allow the wealthy in Greece to escape paying their fair share, which they haven't done in anyone's memory, to sustain the society. They will not permit the mass of people's standard of living to be savaged. They are determined, they say, to default on the large parts of the debt that they acquired on the grounds that the mass of the Greek people didn't want that debt, didn't benefit from that debt, and should not be required to pay off a debt that was incurred by the elite that run the society, and on and on. It's a radical change, move to the left. And if they win in Greece, it will have ramifications all over Europe. And it is a profound sign of the growing anger becoming politically powerful and politically organized to say to the people who run Europe, this crisis is a crisis your system, capitalism, brought. It's a crisis your decisions brought. And you then turned around and used the people's money to bail out the very institutions that brought the crisis. And now you want the people to really pay by a decline in their own standard of living for a system that didn't work and a bailout that bypassed the average person. We won't allow it. So this is a very profound event. And you can see how frightened the people who run Europe are by the blatant intervention in what is a Greek election by politicians, particularly in Germany, but in other countries as well, who want to make sure that the Syriza party doesn't win on the 25th of January. So high officials in many other European countries are telling Greeks, we'll throw you out of the European Union. We will make your life unbearable. Your economic situation will get worse. A kind of attempt to terrorize the voters so they don't vote for a party that breaks with the austerity that has been imposed everywhere. Everyone in Europe will be watching on that election on the 25th. And as we move towards it, the pressures and the tensions will mount. And that's why it's important for you to ask me about it and important for me to try to tell you something about it. We will come back to the question of Greece again and in the not-so-distant future. Next, one of you asked me, is it true that the funding of public schools in the United States has fallen? And if so, isn't this self-destructive of the American economy? Well, I went to something called the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, a wonderful research outfit in Washington, D.C. You can find them on the web under their initials CBPP, very useful. And they have a wonderful report that they did earlier this year. And basically, I'm going to give you the results of that report that answers the question. And I'm going to read it to you so you get it exactly. At least 35 states are providing less funding per student for the 2013-2014 school year than they did before the current recession hit. 14 of those 35 states have cut per student funding by more than 10%. Wow. And I thought you might be interested in my quickly listing to you the 14 states that have cut their funding for public school students by 10% or more. I'm going to start with one that just cut it by 10% and then move up to the worst state that cut it by 23%. Here we go. Starting with the one that cut it by 10.4%, Texas. And here we go. New Mexico, Virginia, Iowa, Mississippi, California, Georgia, Wisconsin, South Carolina, Idaho, Kansas, Arizona, Alabama, and the state that cut it 23%, Oklahoma. Okay, why do I list this? Well, it's not just to answer the question, but to drive home a point. We are in an economic crisis. The question is, how do you deal with it? One of the ways that we as a society are dealing with it is cutting and drastically cutting what we spend on educating our young people. That, not to put too fine a point on it, is craziness, because we are damaging our economic futures as our way of coping with our dysfunctional economic system. That's making a bad problem worse. It's a sign of a society spinning out of control. Lastly, can you provide, third question that we have time for, can you provide a summary of the wealth data and what it tells us about the current so-called economic recovery? Yes, I can. And I can do it in a very simple way. I'm going to make use of another interesting website that I urge you to visit called Too Much Online. That's what it's called, Too Much Online. Sam Pizzigatti, a very good researcher, puts this out. Here's a couple of things in his latest newsletter that I thought you'd be interested in. And again, I'll read it just to make it dramatic. The 400 richest people on Earth added $92 billion to their collective fortune in 2014, bringing their total wealth to $4.1 trillion. The 400 richest people, they added $92 billion. To get a sense of what this means, consider the documents of the Credit Suisse, Research Center. That's one of the biggest banks in Switzerland. They calculate that over the 1 billion people of Africa, the total population of Africa, if you add up their wealth, it's 2.8 billion. That's what they say. In other words, the 400 richest added more wealth than all the people of Africa combined have. And even if these numbers are not correct, and there's some question in my mind about them, nonetheless, the comparison says it all. And here's another one. The 100 biggest campaign donors here in the United States in the 2014 election cycle, according to Politico, a well-known website, gave $323 million to political candidates and parties of their choice. That compared, that, remember what I just said, the 100 biggest donors. That compares to what was given by the 4.75 million Americans who gave less than $200. The 4.75 million Americans who gave less than $200 gave together roughly what the 100 richest folks gave. Can you imagine what a society is like in which the 100 richest give that amount of money compared to what everybody else gives, compared to the majority who don't give anything because they don't have anything to give or don't want to. You're talking about a society that is not responsive to its democratic principles, but to where the money is. But here's the best way to answer the question bluntly and quickly. Edward N. Wolfe, who spells his name exactly the way I do, although there's no relation between us, is one of the great authorities on the distribution of wealth in the United States. Along with Thomas Piketty and Emmanuel Saez, these three are perhaps the most famous researchers. And he has a recent paper, he's written many papers, issued by the National Bureau of Economic Research, a very well-respected research agency here in the United States, and released last month in December of 2014, it's Household Wealth. And basically, here's what he shows, that the median household, the household in the middle in America, lost almost 44% of its wealth. By wealth, he means your house, your car, whatever stocks and bonds and savings you have, less your debts, your net worth, dropped by 44% between 2007 and 2010, the great crash. And then between 2010 and 2013, it was flat. It was flat. One more time. It was flat. It didn't recover. The wealth of Americans has dropped catastrophically in this downturn, and it has not recovered. That has to be weighed against all of the material we're reading about economic recovery. The wealth of the average American family has been savaged. It hasn't recovered, and that's one of the reasons why the economy as a whole is as shaky and its upturn as narrowly benefiting only a tiny number, as all the statistics now show. Okay, we're about to turn over to the second half of the show. We're going to take our short break as we always do. Then please come back and we will have our interview with our guest from London, economics professor John Weeks. Talk to you again in a few seconds.
Open, but nothing comes out. I'm feeling no relief in my head, just doubt. But my heart keeps telling me, hold your ground. You'll never learn a thing if you bail out now. Tonight, I can feel it like a knot in my side. They keep saying this is part of the ride, but I'm not getting stronger. But hold me again.
Welcome, friends. Economic Update here, the weekly program that investigates the economic dimensions of our lives. This is Richard Wolff, your host, and we turn now. And it is my great pleasure to welcome John Weeks to the program. John, thank you very much for joining me in the studio today.
It's my privilege. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Good. Let me start by introducing you to the audience. John Weeks is actually a Texan, comes from the United States. You'll probably hear it in his accent. But he has been living for many, many years in London. He's a retired professor of economics at the University of London, and his most recent book is called Economics of the 1%, How Mainstream Economics Serves the Rich, Obscures Reality, and Distorts Policy. It was published in 2014 by the Anthem Press, and I urge you to take a look at it. It is a no-holds-barred, straight-talking piece of work in economics that I think you'll find very, very interesting, especially if you find this program worth listening to. His column called Economics for the 99% appears on the Real News Network, and he also has a blog on the Huffington Post. He has advised governments in Europe, Africa, Latin America, and Asia on macroeconomic policy, and has most recently worked with the central bank of Zambia. All right, John, that's an impressive resume. And as one economics professor to another, can you begin by giving us an overall sense of what your book is about and why you wrote it?
I think that the problem with economics is that people revere it. People who know nothing about economics, they may say, you know, oh, well, Larry Summers is someone else. He seems like he's a real reactionary. But he's got all this technical knowledge, and at least the facts that he comes, analysis he comes forward with, we have to take seriously. I want to teach people that they don't have to take that seriously. That's actually all a bunch of nonsense. It's a bunch of pernicious, reactionary nonsense put together in a fantasy world that whose purpose is to defend capitalism, and it's based upon a never-never land which serves the wealthiest people in the United States and in the world as a whole.
Okay, so your argument is it's like a rationalization, a justification. It's almost as though what we expect from a Madison Avenue ad agency telling us why to buy this cereal has now been developed as a whole quote-unquote science of economics as to why we should buy capitalism.
Yeah, exactly. And even more than that, it's like a computer virus. It serves as a virus of the mind. Once it gets into your mind, you know this, you took economics courses. If you study economics courses, it's then mainstream. It takes you years to clear your mind of it, unless you're very, very fortunate and have very good teachers. So the purpose of my book is to say, particularly for you people who know no economics, you've actually got an advantage. Mm-hmm. You don't have to get all this stuff out of your mind. I mean, it took me 30 years to clear my mind of it, at least 30 years. And so what my book does is it tries to say, this is what the real economics should be, and those others are fakers. They are practicing fakenomics. They are economic fakers. We're the economists, but we've been purged from the Klan. And I think Marxists were always heretics, so they were never part of the club. Keynesians were purged from it. Might be better to say that Marxists were insurgents. Keynesians were the heretics, sort of like the Cathars or something like that, thrown out of the church. And so now it is very, very narrow indeed.
Tell me a question that comes right out of what you've just said. If that's the case, why? And maybe you've begun to answer it already. Why is that, what you call fakenomics, so powerful? Why is it so dominant in the world? Why would you explain to us the position it has, that its practitioners sit at Harvard and Yale and Princeton and all the other elite schools, and that the politicians talk in that language, and that the media write about the economy in that language? How do you account for the dominance that this way of thinking has?
Well, of course, it's a question of power. Just today you were talking about you know, big donors and all that. They also give to economics research units. I mean, if you want, no matter how reactionary a research you want to do, you can find money to do it. If you want to prove that the 1% should have more income, you will never go hungry, right? And I think that it is very important to realize that when you talk about capitalism, when people think about capitalism, that they must, the way they think must be distorted. It must be shifted, so they actually don't think about it as it really is. I remember once, back in the 1970s, I've always been a radical, but I think I had the epiphany that made me think about Marx. And strangely enough, it was in an Uncle Scrooge comic strip in the Sunday newspapers. And what happens is, very brief, Donald goes to Uncle Scrooge. He's paid, working for him. He goes out. He buys his gas from Scrooge Petroleum Company. He pays his rent at the Scrooge Real Estate Agency. He goes to Scrooge McDuck supermarkets and buys his groceries. He comes home and he tells his nephews, "Oh, God, I'm broke." And they say, "Well, go ask Uncle Scrooge if you can borrow next year's wages. So next month's wages. And so Donald goes along to Scrooge and tells him. Scrooge says, "Donald, I don't understand. I don't have any trouble keeping my money." That is a deep point.
Yes.
And that's what people need to think about. Capitalists get what they spend. The rest of us spend what we get. And once you understand that, you understand the class nature of capitalism, and you understand why all of those fakers in Harvard and Yale and all the way down to Slippery Rock State Teachers College, why all of those people, you have to have all those ideologues trying to tell them that the world is different from the way it is.
All right. Okay. Good. I made a point today of talking a little bit about the resistance of some economists at the last meeting of the American Economic Association. From your vantage point in London, could you tell us whether there is resistance to mainstream neoclassical economics and its way of thinking in England and in Europe that American audiences, and indeed audiences around the world, could learn? Is there a resistance to this, and what is it like?
I don't want to be too optimistic, but I do see changes coming. I was in Boston at the meetings you referred to. I went to the Adbusters demonstration. I went along, and they had wanted some professors to ask questions. I did that, and some other people did too. So that's very optimistic. But I can't comment on how strong they are here, but I can talk about Britain. There are several organizations, and they cooperate with each other, one at the University of Manchester called Post-Crash Economics, and another group on how to teach economics after the crash. Then and those, both of those organizations have, I don't want to exaggerate, they have hundreds of members, which when you consider they're all economic students, we're talking about a significant minority. However, I think just as in our generation, the chances of changing the mainstream of the profession in a substantial way is very, very slight. They do their job. They're paid to do their job, and we aren't going to shift them. And they are much more entrenched and reactionary than they were in our generation. So I wouldn't be terribly optimistic. I don't know where the opposition is going to go, but it's there, and I think it's growing.
Okay. As I have mentioned on this program, and that I'm sure many of our listeners have already know, in many parts of the world, the dominance of the neoclassical, the notion that capitalism is an efficient and egalitarian even system that rewards everybody for their contribution to production, and all of that rationalization of the status quo, is not only dominant, but even excludes the kinds of folks who like capitalism and want to preserve it, but think that it has flaws and problems and that the government needs to step in. We usually call those folks Keynesians of one kind or another, and they have a hard enough time functioning. But it seems that nowadays, even the Keynesians are having a hard time getting a hearing in large parts of the world. And even when they do, that seems to be the limit of what's considered allowable debate in economics, so that the position of someone who thinks capitalism isn't a good system and that the human race can and should do better is simply ruled out before you even get into the conversation. Is that your experience also, because you've been around the world, you've done a lot of work? How would you assess, outside of North America and Western Europe, the condition of economics as a discipline in terms of the dominance of this mainstream neoclassical, as it's called, versus the marginally or somewhat critical Keynesianism and the much more critical Marxism?
First, I'll give some bad news, and then I hope I'll give a little bit of good news. I think that this tendency to expel the heretics is also very strong in Britain. It is moved in France and onto the continent. I mean, certainly 20 years ago, there were very few neoclassicals in French universities. Now, pretty much, they've taken them over. They have great influence in Hollande's government, for example. And I just want to say as a side before I go on the other part, what people have to understand, it's not that I have my views and you have your views and Mankiw has his views. His views are nonsense. And I don't want to sound too sectarian, but why are they nonsense? They are constructed on a presumption that the world is at full employment. The entire neoclassical world is a world of full employment. That's why, you know, we go into the grocery store and we don't sort of look at our money and say, oh, my God, what can I buy with this? We go in and say, ah, those soap suds are 2 cents more than these soap suds, so I think I'll get the ones that are cheaper. That's nonsense. It really is. That is a world of full employment. Prices matter in the world of full employment. When you have unemployment, and God knows you've had unemployment most of the time in market capitalist economies, when you have unemployment, it's your income that matters. And that's what they deny, and they have to deny. And that's why they go into such detail to prove what looks like unemployment actually isn't. Okay, now, on the positive side, France, for all the negative things about France, like the rise of fascism again with Le Pen and so on, has a very active group of dissident economists. It is probably the most active one in the Western world. And so that's very optimistic. In Africa, this is a case perhaps maybe a child shall lead them. Little bitty countries are now governments, straight governments, we aren't talking about radical governments, are sick of having the World Bank and the IMF come along and give them this fakeonomics advice, and they've actually moved to do something about it. In 2009, I gave the keynote speech at the meeting of African finance ministers in Freetown, and basically called for countercyclical policies and what loosely can be called Keynesian policies. There was a tremendously positive reaction to it. So I think that things are changing. Brazil, Argentina, would be the ones that come to mind most. But it is going to be a very hard struggle. I would say one of the few positive things is actually the United States is in decline. You have said it's really a society disintegrating in some ways. And one aspect of that is its disintegration now internationally. However, we've got some new reactionary powers coming up that would be glad to take its place that we have to resist, and Germany is one of them. If we want to talk about Greece, I could say a few things about
please,
that.
Please.
A lot of people say, oh, well, yeah, it's terrible. All those things you said about Greece, Richard, it's really terrible. Those people are suffering. But, I mean, they spent more than their incomes, didn't they? I mean, they lived beyond their means, and the government was corrupt and all this sort of stuff. So what are you going to do? It comes home to roost. No, that's nonsense. What happened in Greece? Sure, they should have been a little bit tighter in their bookkeeping. What happened in Greece was German mercantilism. That is what the European crisis is about. It's about, at the end of the 1990s, a social democratic government. I mean, one of the great scandals of Western Europe is how the social democrats have disgraced themselves in country after country, bringing in austerity, you know, in Spain, in Greece, in Germany. In Germany at the end of the 1990s, the social democratic government convinced the trade union movement to take a wage freeze. And then they changed the tax laws basically to subsidize the big exporters. We've been here before, big German companies bringing about reactionary changes. I don't want to push that too far, but I think it's worth pushing too far. And Germany went from a trade balance in the year 2000 to a massive surplus now. And the deficits are in Spain, Greece, Italy, Portugal, all the countries along the south. And so that's why we have a crisis. And it sure manifests itself in a fiscal crisis. And the reason is, as you were saying, I think in one of your previous programs, what happened is basically the Greek government nationalized the debt. There'd been these debts which were accumulated by banks. Why were they being accumulated by banks? It's because there was a tremendous trade deficit, so you had to borrow to import. Then when the crisis came, the Greek government had to take it over. That is the story. It's a story of a dysfunctional global, continental economic system.
Good. No, very important to get that out. I mean, wish we had more time to deal with the whole Greek situation and the gap between Germany, France, a little bit Scandinavia on the one hand, and Southern Europe. But I want to hold on to where we were going and push you a little further. Here, after all, we are sitting, 2015, coming off the worst global capitalist crisis since the Great Depression, one that wasn't supposed to happen. We were supposed to have developed the tools to manage our capitalism so that this didn't happen. That was false. Then we were told, okay, it's a short dip and we'll be out of it shortly. That turned out to be false. Then we were told the government can manage this and we'll be out of it soon. That was false. We're 7 years into it. And for the mass of people, as I tried to show earlier in this program, there is no recovery to speak of. No matter how entrenched a dominant school of economics is that says everything is okay, it can't, can it, keep surviving in the face of this degree of dysfunction? So let me put it as a question. Do you think that the ongoing economic declines confronting the mass of people in Western Europe, North America, Japan, the old centers of capitalism, as capitalism, in a sense, moves to China, India, Brazil, and so on, do you not think that this will eventually provoke the new ways of thinking and the refusal to continue accepting the dominance of the old ways of thinking simply because the reality is so different?
I hope so. What I think is this. I think that you're quite right. It is clear that in terms of achieving a stable capitalism, these policies are dysfunctional. The deregulation and particularly the financial sector leads to instability. So why does it go on? I think that a very important part of it in Europe and perhaps in the United States too is that the big capitalist says to itself, we have the chance to destroy the welfare state once and for all. And we may never get this chance again. And it's worth going through this pain in terms of lower profits or whatever they happen to be. Of course, some people's profits are going up. It's worth going through this to achieve that. Because when we've achieved it, we will not only be in charge, we will be 99% in charge. And I think that's part of what's going on here. And so I think that the key to prevent that from happening is the organization of the working class. I mean, that's how the capitalists got to where they are now. They were able to crush the working class, particularly in the United States in the 1970s, 1980s. And now they face very little organized opposition. And I think my son is a trade union organizer in Britain. I think that is the hope. And that's a hope not only for ending instability, that's a hope for preventing a new wave of authoritarianism in the Western world.
So on one level, you have some optimism that this might emerge, this process.
I do have some optimism, yeah.
All right.
It's really it's going to be the struggle of your younger listeners, though. Not going to happen soon.
I want to thank you, John Weeks. I want to remind all of us, get a copy of this book, this new book, Economics of the 1%, John F. Weeks. Before we close our program for today, let me remind you, please, we maintain these two websites, rdwolf2fs.com and democracyatwork.info. These are available to you 24/7. They will contain this program archived as we archive all of our programs and available to you via podcast and so on. The websites also allow you to communicate to us. If you like today's shows, if you want to communicate to Professor Weeks, all of that is possible through either website. They will show you how to reach us in a very easy way. Likewise, both websites will allow you, by clicking on a simple icon, to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest, and use the benefits of social media to keep in touch with us. I want to thank truthout.org, a remarkable independent source of news and analysis every day. Check them out at truthout.org. And finally, I travel around the country. I'm available to give talks in a variety of places. Get in touch with us through the websites. Please remember also to provide financial support to your local radio station that carries this program. We are very proud that we're now coming up to 40 stations around the country that carry this program on the radio. Please support your local radio station financially, and please also consider supporting us, both of those websites, rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info. Have donation buttons that enable you to do that. This is a new year. We need to once again do our fundraising. So I do need to appeal to you to do that kind of thing for us as well, so that we can bring more people like Professor Weeks to talk to you, and that we can assemble the materials that we present on each of these programs. We will be following the events in Greece very closely, just like we will be following closely all of the mounting evidence that 2015 may be a very complicated and difficult year for the world economy in general. That's already clear by the gyrations of the stock markets in the opening days of this year. And it is also clear in the mounting evidence that we will be discussing on this program. Thank you once again for joining me, and I look forward to speaking with you again next week. Your time now, babe. But after a while, it's gonna be my time, babe. They ain't gonna change. Change, change, change. Change, change, change.